Rosemary Martirana, Director of Intelligence here at the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, NJOHSP, and you're listening to Intelligence Unclassified. This podcast is exactly what the title states, unclassified information about current trends in homeland security for the state of New Jersey, as well as educational information and resources for your awareness. Although it is produced every month, we aim to stay on top of current events and will often offer additional content. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. Please feel free to add this podcast to your RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow NJOHSP on Twitter at NJOHSP and Facebook. All links can be found in the show note and on our website, www.njohsp.gov.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Dean Barada from the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. I'd like to welcome you all to the March edition of our monthly intelligence webinar. And today we are actually experimenting with something a little different, a slightly different format. Last week, we had our annual Homeland Security Conference here in New Jersey. And what we try to do with those is bring in law enforcement, Homeland Security professionals, private sector entities throughout the state and talk about emerging and important trends and themes related to Homeland Security. So what we thought we'd do today is actually get our director and senior staff together to sort of review the conference, talk about what their key takeaways were, and expand a little bit on some of those themes and ideas. So what I'm going to do is ask them to introduce themselves, tell you a little bit about the position they have now and how they got here, and we'll start with our director, Dr. Rodriguez.
Thanks, Dean. I'm Chris Rodriguez, Director of the Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. Before this position, I served for over a decade in the Central Intelligence Agency.
Great. Thank you, sir. My name is Rosemary Martirana. I'm the Director of Intelligence here at the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. I've been with the office now 6 years. It'll be in September. I started as a Senior Intelligence Analyst here and acquired this position over a year ago.
I'm Dave Weinstein. I'm the Director of Cybersecurity for the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness.
Hi, my name is Jared Maples. I'm the Director of Administration here at NJOHSP, focused on internal and business operations of our agency. I, too, like Chris, came from a long background at the Central Intelligence Agency prior to coming here.
And hi, my name is Eric Tazarczyk. I'm the Director of Policy and Planning here at NJOHSP. I'm the newest member of the team with various positions in federal, state government, as well as the private sector.
So before we begin talking about the conference last week, yesterday we obviously had the attacks in Belgium and wanted to see if the director wanted to say a few words in relation to that.
Thanks, Dean. I think that the conference we had on Friday certainly was a gathering of local, state, and federal officials that is becoming all the more important, particularly given what happened in Brussels yesterday. And certainly our hearts, thoughts and prayers go out to the over 36 families who have been affected, as well as the over 200 men and women who were injured as a result of the attacks. You know, as we move forward, I think that we've seen a terrorist landscape that has become much more decentralized and diffuse. The threat of terrorism has certainly evolved and grown since 9/11, and our adversaries are more committed than they've ever been. And I think that now more than ever, our efforts to reach the public at the unclassified level and to assist, again, our local, state, and federal partners is all the more important. And we need to have a renewed vigilance in the face of these new threats. And that's why we host these forums and these webinars. And that's why I appreciate what our partners do every day. You know, Director Brennan of the CIA at our conference mentioned that intelligence is not an end in itself, and that intelligence is only useful when it's going to be used to empower or enable, to interdict, to stop, and to thwart some of the key threats that we face today. And so that's really a guiding principle of our office, is to use intelligence to empower our partners and to ensure that the citizens of New Jersey, and certainly the citizens of the United States, are as safe and secure as they can be. So thank you.
So, like the director said, our first speaker at the conference was John Brennan, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. And one of the, you know, he brought up a number of key points he really wanted to emphasize. And one of those was that in his experience, he said he's never seen a time when the volume and complexity of problems that we're facing on the world stage are greater. And so we don't really operate on the world stage, though. We operate on a state stage. So how do you all think, you know, I was curious how you guys think about that assessment from our perspective at the state level. Do we have challenges that maybe national governments don't have to worry about? Or can the nationwide agencies handle the real complexity and we have it a little easier? What do y'all think?
It's a really good question. I think, you know, we don't operate on the world stage, but we certainly face global threats, right? So our motto has been for over a year now, global threats, local response. And I think we are faced with a unique situation in New Jersey because increasingly so, not just on the counterterrorism side, but on the cybersecurity side as well, we're confronting actors from all over the world, whether they're actually perpetrating the attacks from overseas or they're being inspired from overseas. I can say on the cybersecurity front, then I'll let Rosemary talk more about the CT side, but most of the threats that we encounter on a daily basis do stem from overseas, particularly in Asia and Eastern Europe. So the question is, how do different levels of government come together to address these global threats, right? The federal government doesn't have a monopoly in this day and age on threats emanating from overseas. So here in New Jersey, in order to protect our interests, trying to leverage the partnerships we have with local authorities, state authorities, of course, but also with federal authorities to pool our resources, share intelligence to ultimately deter and defeat threats coming from overseas.
Yeah, and I'll just, you know, add to that as well from a counterterrorism perspective. We are in a very complex threat environment currently. You know, as our director indicated, we're dealing with a much more diffuse and decentralized threat. So yes, we are aware of the threats emanating from overseas, like from groups like the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria and Al-Qaeda. But yet these groups overseas have the capability to inspire individuals here in the United States, that homegrown violent threat. And although, you know, we work with our federal partners, it's, you know, critical that a state agency like us also work closely with our local law enforcement partners because it's more of a grassroots approach. We need to understand what those individuals are seeing on the ground level so that we can share that information with the intelligence community at large.
I think I would say what's unique to New Jersey from that comment is that, as Dave and Rosemary alluded to, and as the director said, the information and intelligence we get can empower action. And unlike the federal government, I think sometimes our challenge is our authorities may stop at the border, but those threats do not. And so we have to really build those partnerships with, as they said, the other local governments, but as well as the private sector, and try to encourage folks to prepare and find a way to build that resiliency, as we say, to ensure that they're better able to face those threats and take actions that can ensure the public safety.
So as Dave kicked off, it seems to me like if you think back to threats that we had maybe 40 years ago or 50 years ago, if you weren't a nation state actor, generally the means at your disposal to harm somebody was a gun or a bomb, right? I mean, so your range was maybe in several hundred meters. Whereas now, between cyber, if you can get on a plane and hijack it, there's the ease of global travel and the media, that range really seems like it's extended to hundreds or thousands of miles, right? So it almost sounds like now at the state level, we're facing the same sorts of threats that only a country would face, or from another country, you know, 40 years ago, 50 years ago. So would you then say, like, is it better to say, is it more complex? Is it more challenging for us because we seem to have now the same level of threats, but a much smaller pool of resources?
One thing I would add into that, and I think that it's a great point, that makes New Jersey different in some regards is the access to transportation, the access to the ports, all the infrastructure elements that we have as a state make us an incredibly important player on those complex issues, the global issues. So it's not just the technology. It's also the intent and capability, the ability to impact. We're right in the heart of this thing. The Lieutenant Governor talked about the most dangerous 2 miles in America, and that rings true. So that's an issue, not just from the technology part, but also the access and the things that we're trying to protect here from the state level.
So now that we just freaked everybody out, what's the upside of that? You know, we've talked about, okay, we have vulnerabilities and threats that we didn't have maybe 40 years ago. Where is the optimism there? Where's the, you know, the upside for us?
Well, you know, I'm not sure I'd characterize it as an upside. I would say states in many respects are well positioned to react to this new phenomena, right? And this is a new phenomena in which distance is really not as much of a factor as you described. Barriers to entry for all sorts of actors, whether they are cyber actors, CT actors, are lowering. And the tools they're using to cause impact are more ubiquitous and proliferating. So when you think about a world like that, then you talk about, okay, what type of organization and institution needs to be in place to deal with that threat? And I think you usually arrive at an answer where it's a really adaptive, flexible, flat organization. the federal government is great at a lot of things. They're not often the most flexible or adaptive. So there are, I think, opportunities for state governments, local authorities that tend to be more adaptive, more flexible, to complement the robust capabilities and resources that the federal government has to deal with this new norm.
And so an advantage I think we have at the state level as well is that as the threat landscape has shifted, as Dave said, we have the ability to adapt not only in the face of that threat, but also in terms of adopting new strategies. So global threats, local response requires the law enforcement, homeland security community within a particular state to develop relationships with the public and the community. And the federal government, while again, it does have robust resources, is never going to be able to match state and local authorities in terms of their relationships with the community and with the public. And those relationships not only are useful in day-to-day interactions, but also in countering the threats that we're seeing, not only across the world, but also here in the U.S.
So the second point that Director Brennan brought up was he said he felt the tide had turned against ISIS on the battlefield in Iraq and Syria. Of course, you know, that was a few days before the Belgium attacks. And of course, we had the attacks in Paris in November. And with those and the accompanying media coverage, kind of wall-to-wall coverage that we have, you could see how members of the public might get an opposite impression of that. So how should people think about risk when it comes to terrorism? And how would you all think they should gauge if things are getting more or less safe for them?
So I think Director Brennan, you know, made a good point. And actually, Clint Watts, who followed Director Brennan on stage, really drove that point home as well and kind of reiterated that ISIS is past its peak. You know, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, ISIS, it's really starting to, you know, kill off its own members. They're not really winning anymore like they were a year ago. They're losing ground, in fact, and, you know, internal leaks even in their own organization have left them somewhat vulnerable. And, you know, oftentimes they take on that criminal role as opposed to more of that pious role. So that being said, I do think the organization could be past its peak. However, it still is capable of inspiring individuals locally to act. And so I think that's something we need to continuously keep in mind. You know, one of the other things, you know, that was mentioned was even if they're not directing attacks, you know, they can still network attacks as well. And I think that's what we've seen in Paris and Belgium. And it's a little concerning, especially for our European partners. I think here in the United States, you know, we're a little less vulnerable to those foreign fighter flows coming out of Syria and Iraq. Europe is obviously more vulnerable to that or susceptible to that threat. Not to say we are removed from it, but that ocean does provide us a little wiggle room there.
So one of the things I think of when I'm talking to folks, if they're old enough to remember, is I'm often reminded of when I used to read World War II history, the Germans in 1944, they launched a counterattack called the Battle of the Bulge. And so everyone, if you looked at their status, they were on the ropes, they were getting beaten all over the place, but they were still able to launch a pretty large attack. And so ISIS might be very similar, right? Where, yeah, they're getting beat. Maybe it's inevitable that they will be defeated, but they can still sort of mass and conduct attacks in any number of places. And so it's useful to sort of keep that in mind. So given all the coverage that we see after these attacks, what are your thoughts on resiliency among the population? And does that have a negative effect? Is there some way we can contribute to building resiliency? I don't want to say get people desensitized to it, but again, when you think of history and whether it's World War II or some other time, people have gone through pretty traumatic, lengthy periods and sort of made it through that. What's your sense of sort of how we're doing and how we can do better in resiliency?
To answer directly your question, I think we can absolutely promote and build that resiliency posture without making people desensitized to it. It's funny you bring up the World War II analogy. When you look back, you see the civil defense posture that this country had and some of the states had, and some of the activities, even as simple as the response or preparedness action for a nuclear attack was to get under a wooden desk and hope that that was your safety. Whereas today, when we see threats and a point aptly made that are not just man-made, we see a cacophony of threats. We're promoting that resiliency mission. We want to look for folks to be able to anticipate what's coming. And that could be resiliency against a hurricane, as we saw in New Jersey during Hurricane Sandy, being prepared. We want them to be able to adapt to what's going on around them. And we want them to take actions so that they can recover. And I think that if we can promote that message, we'll at least reduce the risk of desensitizing them to what could just be seen as a term of art and actually encourage positive forward-leaning actions.
And I think during Sandy, our public, New Jersey public, responded really well, right? And a lot of that seemed to be, well, we seemed to be sort of very forward-leaning sort of officially, but also a lot of people were leveraging technology to sort of build their own resilience, right? And talking to each other, using social media about, hey, these gas stations are open and here's where you can get a generator. I don't know, Dave, I'm going to put you on the spot here and say, you know, where do you see technology, right? Technology can also pass along sort of the most heinous enemy propaganda videos, but can also help. So
yeah, so no doubt technology can sometimes introduce risk or help deliver, in this case, the adversary's message or sometimes techniques. But it's also a force for good in terms of building resilient networks, whether it's at the community level, the state level, even the national level. This whole notion of crowdsourcing, using technology to maintain a certain operational cadence on the government side, or even if it's within a community, in the event of some sort of natural or man-made threat, I think is really viable. Another thing I want to point to real quickly, which I don't think gets enough credit, we were touching on it, I think, is this whole notion of kind of mental resilience in the wake of these types of incidents, right? If you step back and think about what, in the case of Belgium, also in the case of Paris, San Bernardino, etc., ISIS is trying to achieve, is you're trying to mentally break down the public to influence public policy decisions, in our case in Washington, perhaps in the case of Belgium in Brussels and the EU. I think it's important for the public to recognize that that is the strategic intent of the adversary in this case, so that we don't fold mentally to the fear tactics that are being perpetrated. I think that's maybe the most important type of resilience in the face of some of these threats. Of course, that's not nearly as relevant to the cybersecurity discussion, but certainly, I think, relevant to resilience in the context of counterterrorism.
I was just going to say, I mean, that's an interesting point. I mean, and it's easier said than done at times. I mean, even in Brussels, we're seeing now, you know, the threat levels have been elevated, transportation shut down throughout the country, you know, especially in the city yesterday. It's much easier said than done. I don't know if you have any comments on that end of it, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think this is where community comes into play. We saw it in Paris, we're seeing it in Belgium, in order to, in some way, turn an event like this to actually bring people together and make the community stronger as a result of it, and ultimately more resilient. But I think this is the hardest challenge that we face with these types of attacks, is maintaining a certain level of mental stability to prevent the public policy decisions that ultimately the terrorists are trying to influence in the first place.
I think it's an interesting point, harking back a little nearer past than World War II, but in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, I always found one of the greatest things that happened was, you know, Yankee Stadium, they continued on with the playoff game, the president threw the first pitch out. That was a clear message of unity across about our way of life, right? So baseball, if you look at Brussels as an example, soccer, of course, football being a huge pastime there. You know, perhaps some sort of international friendly match between Germany and Belgium, or, you know, and host in the national stadium and have the president there kind of reach out and have this presence at that stadium would be an example of something to kind of portray that, no, our way of life is going to continue on. Something that is important from a social aspect is important for us to do. So in context of Belgium, that would be an interesting piece, again, kind of looking at our experiences here in America.
So it's interesting. Two thoughts came to mind. One, we were talking about sort of individual resilience. The first image that came to mind was Flight 93 on 9/11, where, and I forget his name, I apologize, the guy whose last words were, "Let's roll," right? I mean, that is sort of the ultimate resilience in the face of really bad news, and just saying, we've got a job to do, we've got to do it. And so I thought that just popped in my mind. I'm not sure if there's a role at the state or any government level to develop that, or if that's something that families and communities need to just sort of build themselves. I'm not really sure what your thoughts are on that. And then question on a totally different subject, kind of. When it comes to resiliency, and you were talking about in terms of the cyber realm, do you think it's fair to say that there is some role for resiliency there if people sort of lose faith in the security of their networks and their ability to do their banking online, that sort of thing, because they think their information will get stolen? They still need some sort of sense of resiliency there as well? Or am I mixing up my terms there?
I think you're right. I think another word I'd use is integrity and confidence in the information systems that we depend on, not only in, you know, under exigent circumstances in the event of catastrophe like this, but also in our everyday lives. We're increasingly encountering situations where we're beginning to question the integrity of systems that we rely on for our day-to-day lives. So resiliency in the context of maintaining the integrity, but also the availability and confidentiality of data is part and parcel of this conversation, a little obviously separate from the contingency situation that we're discussing. But no doubt resiliency is part of the broader cybersecurity discussion and the risk management discussion, I think, which is what we're ultimately getting to.
I'd like to just return for a second to the issue of mental resiliency. You know, this office expends considerable resources in building relationships with the community, but also with the interfaith community and with the private sector, as Eric had mentioned before. So, for example, right after the attacks in Paris and the attacks in Brussels yesterday, we were convening conference calls with those entities and representatives and briefing them out on what we knew about the attacks and what steps we were taking on the ground to ensure that people in our transportation hubs were able to travel safely and securely. So a big part of mental resiliency, I think, is being frank with the public and telling them what we know and what we don't know within, obviously, certain limits in terms of classification of information and intelligence. But I think being upfront and breaking down those barriers that sometimes exist between the public and law enforcement and Homeland Security, I think, is a really important part of mental resiliency.
Mm. Talk about government's role, and to circle back to Director Brennan's comments about intelligence and information being an enabler and an empowerer, I think, to your question, Dean, that's the role of government in this space, is to enable and empower that mental resiliency. Mm-hmm. That's what we've been doing.
And if there, to go back to your, what is the optimism in this scenario? It's that with that information, both from the physical side, whether it be cyber or physical structures, or the mental side, as was touched on, and to be honest with people and understand that there are people dedicated to reducing, or what I would say, buying down risk, but at the same time, it can't be completely eliminated. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where our partnerships and the information flow will help motivate people to build that resiliency, whether physically in the cyber realm or with private sector partners, or as the director mentioned, mentally with the upfront information that we can get.
And sticking with the theme of the conference, of course, Deb Scully came and spoke about her role in Newtown. I think it's interesting, and one of the things that stood out to me on the conference side is that it really brought together the integrated structure that our office is focused on. So you have counterterrorism mission, the cyber, it was, of course, Dave did his session with U.S. Attorney Fishman. But that was a really interesting aspect for me coming in from the federal government, looking into the state government. We do have that those touch points. Direct touch points. It was interesting to hear her comments, but it also had me focus on kind of where our role fits into that regard as well. And I think talking about it is the first huge step.
So the next set of speakers were focused on sort of Homeland Security threats, more the counterterrorism side. And we had three speakers. Clint Watts, who has worked with us many times before, is an expert on Al-Qaeda, jihadi groups, things like that. Lauren Steinberg, who is a terrorism analyst with the ADL. And Ehsan Zafir, who is with the Department of Homeland Security's Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties. So rather than sort of break each one of those down individually, I kind of wanted to have you guys walk us through sort of what you thought were sort of the themes that may have run through those three discussions and what your takeaways were from those.
So one of the big themes I think I picked up on from Clint through Lauren's presentation as well as through Ehsan's presentation was, you know, the idea of these foreign terrorist organizations and to a certain extent domestic terrorist organizations capitalizing on social media. In other words, really using platforms like Twitter, Telegram, Kik, WhatsApp, and AskFM to their advantage. And Clint touched on that in the beginning, especially when he was talking about how, you know, ISIS, of course, has used social media throughout the extent of, you know, their time in Syria and Iraq. And Lauren kind of talked about how that resonates with our local communities here. And then Ehsan talking about how we can counter those messages. But it's impressive how far a group like ISIS has really taken it in the last year. You know, some of our analysts here at the office have, you know, found evidence of ISIS, you know, sending out approximately 90,000 unique tweets a day, and of course, enjoying about 46,000 supporters online. And their capabilities have far expanded those of Al-Qaeda, of Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, and they've really taken it to the next level, which was one theme I thought resonated throughout all three of those speakers.
So follow-up question there. Another sort of issue that they all touched on one way or the other is the vulnerability to recruitment and CVE, or countering violent extremism. So that is kind of the buzzword of the day right now, or the buzz phrase of the day. And intentions are certainly noble, right? We want to prevent particularly young folks from sort of getting involved in violent extremism. But the term itself has acquired a bit of a negative connotation with it as well. So we have interfaith advisory, we have interfaith outreach communities. How do we navigate between those two things, those two poles of trying to sort of help, again, particularly young folks, you know, 25 and younger, while avoiding this sort of negative connotation that often is associated with it?
Look, I mean, I think we need to be out there. I participated in a variety of panels with the Attorney General of New Jersey, the U.S. Attorney for New Jersey, the head of the FBI here in the state, and looking at young people and engaging them and allowing them the opportunity to ask questions of some of the top law enforcement professionals in the state, I think is really important. We did several panels over the last year, and we want to continue to do those. And to get those senior officials in one room answering those questions, I think is really important in order to break down those barriers.
Yeah, and I'll just add to the director's comments here. I think when it comes to countering a violent narrative, sometimes you don't need to counter it. You need to offer alternative narratives. So that's one thing to keep in mind. But also, I think we need to take on more of a holistic approach when it comes to offering those alternative narratives or countering those narratives. And that's to not only focus on our faith-based communities, but also involve community members that you wouldn't normally leverage, that law enforcement might not have a regular partnership with. So your school resource officers, YMCAs, and other organizations like that, that often see these individuals and could be another way to kind of bring this information to light.
Now, one of the things that both Clint Watts and Laura Steinberg talked about was it seems like some of the very characteristics that draw people to extremist organizations, the need to belong, the need to do something greater than themselves, opportunity, that sort of thing, seems to be sort of perennial problems. Back in the 90s, this was a reason why folks joined gangs. In the 80s, this is why people got involved with drugs. So is this even an extremism problem, or is it something else that sort of is bigger than extremism, do you think?
I think it's a lot of things. You know, terrorist recruiters will try to invoke those feelings in susceptible young men and women in terms of belonging. And those are the things that I think really appeal to disenfranchised youth in terms of needing to be part of something that's greater than themselves. And along that process, they become radicalized in a way that compels them to join a terrorist group. So I think it's those basic human needs that recruiters will appeal to in those young men and women that will eventually get them on that bad path. So the important thing for us is to, and for the law enforcement homeland security community, is to intervene as early as possible with the help of the community in order to ensure that those people are not robbed of their youth by some of these recruiters.
Yeah, just quickly before we maybe change the topic, but I thought it was interesting how especially Clint Watts had described Al-Qaeda as kind of your dad's rock band, right? So there's not a lot of young individuals looking at to join Al-Qaeda right now, yet ISIS has this appeal. And I think a lot of that has to do with how you relate to your audience, which any marketing organization could tell you that's how you kind of involve people. So that's something to kind of keep in mind as well.
So after that section of the conference, we moved on to Dave, who had a discussion with Paul Fishman, the U.S. attorney. One of the big issues that sort of ran through the whole conference was the issue of encryption of data. And certainly you brought it out sort of explicitly in your discussion. I was wondering, could you sort of summarize sort of the main points of that discussion?
Sure. Encryption, as all of you are aware, is an issue that is not going away. It is once again a subject in the wake of the Brussels attacks, as analysts are speculating whether or not the terrorists use encrypted communications to plan this operation, perhaps even to carry it out to an extent. So we had a great conversation with the U.S. attorney last week on the subject. Obviously, there's genuine interest on both sides of the coin when it comes to this debate. And here's basically what is being discussed. On the security research, technology, and privacy side of the house, there are concerns that undermining encryption in order to aid law enforcement investigations has significant security, public safety, and privacy implications, not just for protecting against government surveillance, which is, of course, a hot topic in the wake of the Edward Snowden leaks, but more importantly, in my opinion, from protecting against malicious exploitation of this technology from criminals criminal actors, whether they be located in the United States or abroad. So on the other side of the coin, obviously, is law enforcement, which in an age of ubiquitous encryption technology, particularly strong encryption utilized by American technology companies, law enforcement is hindered when it comes to collecting evidence to support prosecutions and ultimately convictions. In an environment in which it's increasingly difficult to convince a jury to get to a conviction in certain cases. So for legitimate reasons on both sides, this debate has come to a head. It's playing out in the mainstream in the context of the FBI Apple case involving the iPhone 5C running iOS 9 of the alleged San Bernardino shooter. That case actually had an interesting development yesterday, or the day before, I believe it was yesterday, when the hearing that was scheduled was delayed because the FBI has claimed that it has consulted with an external party who has the ability to gain access to the encrypted data at risk on the phone of the suspected San Bernardino shooter. So really complex issues at play here. The U.S. attorney did a great job, I think, of laying out, without completely neglecting the importance of encryption, he did a great job of laying out the importance of a solution as it relates to law enforcement. In other words, giving law enforcement the ability to access data at rest with a warrant. We'll see how it plays out in the courts. I think regardless of how it plays out at the magistrate level, it'll probably end up in the Supreme Court. But ultimately, I think the conclusion we reached and that others have reached is that for us to really find a solution that works, this is going to have to go to Capitol Hill. We as a nation are going to have to determine where our level of comfort is in terms of making the trade-off between security and privacy with a keen interest in public safety and law enforcement investigations. But I think this debate is here to stay for a while. We may have reached a solution for the San Bernardino case, but it's important to note that there's dozens of cases open across the country. And what we wanted to shine light on is the fact that most of these cases disproportionately inhibit local and state level law enforcement because they don't have the tools or resources necessary to break into encryption, obviously, or to break encryption, I should say.
Let's flip that on its head, that sort of issue, right? So we're talking about the need to maybe crack encryption of a suspect's data. What about the other way around? We've had some pretty notable breaches of personal data, both privately held and sort of government held. Does this sort of desire for encryption muddle that issue up at all? How should we think about data breaches that we are experiencing where people are trying to break our encrypted data, for example?
Yeah, and this is why I think you've seen the security research community come out in favor of Apple here and much of those in the technology field. It's important to remember Apple is taking the lead here, but Twitter, Facebook, and others have endorsed them in this case. And that is because there is an assessment that the greater good lies with strong encryption, even though it may hinder law enforcement or introduce burdens on law enforcement investigations. The greater good is the ability to lock down data to protect not only these massive breaches that have economic impact, but to protect our personal data for the purposes of promoting privacy within the United States. An interesting development with this last case, and where I think this debate is going next, is if the FBI is able to defeat the encryption on this particular phone, will they share how they did it with the security research community? Because that certainly has implications on our own data protection, our own privacy. Typically, when a vulnerability, which this would be if it were broken, is discovered, it's disclosed, and vendors are tasked with patching that vulnerability. So I think the next debate, if the FBI is successful in breaking into this phone, will be, okay, does the FBI share that information with Apple so that Apple can then patch this vulnerability for this particular operating system that is on millions, tens of millions of phones in the United States and across the world and has implications if it gets into the wrong hands for our own personal data protection?
One thing that stood out for me to his comments is that it's a great example of shifting societal norms. In the past, certain issues like this would go through the traditional think tank and then into maybe a Senate committee, into the executive branch for some of their policymakers to decide on, ultimately the judicial branch. This is a case where, and he mentioned several times, this is being tried by Apple in a public court of opinion, essentially. I found that fascinating. Obviously, he had his thoughts on where it should be kind of held. But that's another thing that I think we'll have to wrestle with in the upcoming years, is that where does this debate need to happen? Right now, it's definitely happening out in public. Apple's driving.
You know, one of the things that the attorney said was he talked about, hey, when cars were first invented, we didn't really know how to legislate them. We figured it out. There, we kind of had time because like they didn't have roads built, right? And now the technology feels like it is just moving so quickly. And same thing we're seeing with unmanned aerial vehicles. The technology and the dissemination of them into broad public use is just so fast. It's kind of outstripping our ability to issue regulations or think about these legally.
One thing I would just add along those lines is this isn't the first time that the introduction of technology or new technology has introduced barriers for law enforcement or even the intelligence community. I mean, there's implications for the intelligence community as it relates to encryption in transit that this discussion hasn't even touched. But back in the mid-90s, and we discussed this during the panel, the Communications Assistance to Law Enforcement Act, or CALEA, was passed and had fairly bipartisan support and was signed by President Clinton once the telecom started moving to digital switches and law enforcement's traditional wiretap techniques were no longer available. So we've encountered this challenge before when you introduce new technology and it creates barriers for law enforcement. The unique thing here is that we're no longer just reconciling burdens between law enforcement and providers. In the case of CALEA, it was telecom. In the case of this, it's tech companies. But now there's a third variable, which is, are there implications for personal privacy or public safety if we provide assistance to law enforcement? And that's where I think there's really good arguments on both sides, and ultimately public should weigh in through their representatives so that we can get to a good sweet spot on this.
Fair to say across the board that issues related to sort of data, data theft, data encryption, cyber attacks, that sort of thing, kind of at the top of the list of the people that you're talking to, either private sector, other government agencies, that sort of thing. Is that just across all areas that...
Rosemary might disagree, but I would say yes, yes, and yes.
We can talk about that offline, but I think, yes, it's a very important issue, and I think it's on the minds of a lot of people. You know, I don't know if it outweighs the terrorism issue, but we'll leave it at that.
I think there is an interesting undercurrent. Director Brennan mentioned the Director of Digital Innovation just created an agency, and it created a horizontal approach to mission sets. One of the things that they recognized there early on was the fact that cyber is interconnected throughout counterterrorism, all the, you know, the aspects that the agency's focused on. And I think to the same degree it's here. Everybody's mentioned different examples. Cyber is an issue. Terrorists use cell phones. Criminals use cell phones. You need cell phones in response to an emergency, a hurricane, etc. So it is one of those issues or topics that sort of weaves itself through all these other areas. So from that degree, it is a very important aspect of this.
In all seriousness, I think that the intersection of the CT mission, the counterterrorism mission, and cybersecurity / technology is where there's a lot of focus. And that's where, when it comes to kind of looking a couple of years down the road and at some of the threats that will probably be our biggest focus, I think that's where we're going to be.
And I think it's important to note, as Jared mentioned, the discipline of cyber. With the private sector, you know, cyber is a vector that will cause cascading risk. So if you ignore the front door, your back door becomes wide open. If that window is left open and you don't see the inherent risk of one vector, then issues can arise that are going to cause either slight disruptions or large disruptions in operations that can then cascade out. So at some point, it doesn't matter what the initial act was if something in that realm can cause such devastating cascading risks. And I think cyber is a place where that occurs. If you're not really strong in that area, it might not matter that there's an intrusion into your network. But what happens once that bad actor gains access could be devastating.
So what I'm going to do is, in the next to last question that I'm going to ask, just going to ask to go around the panel here. And what recommendations do you have for people to, you know, read, watch, listen to, follow, anything like that? Ideally related to this field generally, but we'll throw it open if you just have a great album you want to talk about.
I'm happy to start. So I think when we've quoted Director Brennan a few times, I thought it was interesting that in the question and answer session, he mentioned biological threats, which is something that may have been not placed on the back burner, but not received as much focus recently as it did in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. Through that, I would encourage folks to take a look at The Demon in the Freezer by Richard Preston, which will bring biological focus in that threat vector into the forefront. It's interesting to see how the United States government has handled things like the smallpox vaccine and the smallpox hazard in the past. So that would be my suggestion.
Well, I think first and foremost, people should be reading and watching what we put out on our website and through webinars and all right. But actually, I was just thinking about, you know, I obviously read and watch a lot of different things. I talked a lot about how negative social media can be, but one thing I would encourage people to do is to stay apprised of a lot of the events that are taking place and some other good academics that are out there, is to really create your own tweet deck. I don't think it's an underutilized tool. I think Twitter is a great tool.